Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Testament the last few weeks, and today we're going to be another personality, a very beautiful account, an intimate account, sweet account of a lady's love and extravagance for Jesus. We try sometimes to think about people we know and how they would relate if they lived in the first century, and I think all of us know people who have the kind of tenderness that's going to be shown in the lesson today. I'm going to be dealing, of course, with Mary, who is Martha and Lazarus' sister. And I hope you'll turn me to Mark chapter 14, and I'm going to look at verses 1 through 9. I want to set the stage, if I could. You know, some people in the disciple group got mad when Jesus had an inner group, John, James, Peter. And they thought it was unfair that he should have an inner group. I wonder what people thought when Jesus had close personal friends. It seems that Lazarus and Mary and Martha were some of the closest human friends that Jesus had on earth. And I think it really says something about his humanity that although he was open and friendly and caring to all people, there were some people's homes that he could go in their house, take his shoes off, and sit down and feel relaxed, you know. That's the kind of home that we're going to be talking about today. Now, to get into it, there is a dating problem. And the only reason I go into this, son, is because I feel like that I try to give the background to these lessons so that you can understand them better on a historical, grammatical, theological basis. And verse 1 of chapter 14, it says, "Now the feast of the Passover and of unleavened bread was 2 days later." Now I want to introduce this lesson by talking about the Passover and about the unleavened bread and about this time thing, 2 days. You see, there are several parallels in the gospel to this account. One of the parallels, I think, is inappropriate. In my New American Standard Bible, which I often use when I do the Old Testament, it lists Luke 7, 36 and following as a parallel to this account. But boy, I don't think it is. That's the adulterous woman. It's in the home of a Pharisee. I just don't think that's the account that's happening here. You know, I just don't. But there is a parallel in John chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. And John 12 is so helpful in us putting the two together to really get what the scene was like in Lazarus' home. Okay, now let's talk for a minute about the Passover. The Passover is the high festival day of the Jewish nation. Now, I think the Day of Atonement is the high fast day, the day to deal with sin. But the Passover is a festival day, a day of joyous, hilarious thanksgiving for what God has done, a day of looking back on the years of slavery and thanking God for his act. The Passover is observed on the 14th of the Jewish month of Nisan. And of course, their calendar was a lunar calendar, which means the day changes every year, like Easter on our calendar. Now, unleavened bread is another festival that was added to the festival of Passover. Now, many folks wonder if these feasts or festivals were already in effect culturally before the Exodus. And if the Jews just took them over and put new meaning into them. Well, I really don't know, but there is some evidence that that's true. Rashi, a Jewish commentator of the Middle Ages, says that when Lot fed the three angels, he fed them matzahs. That's the special food for the Passover, unleavened bread deals. Because it was that time of year, and if Lot was doing it, think how much earlier that was than the Exodus. Now, it does say in the Exodus experience that Moses told Pharaoh, "Let my people go 3 days' journey in the wilderness and sacrifice to me." And some say this was already a set yearly festival, and that Moses just happened to pick up on the time for the death angel to pass over. And we have a combination of these 2 days into our modern Passover. It's hard for me to analyze that. There's no way to make an intellectual comparison. Obviously, people take over traditional holidays and put new meaning into it. Christmas is a beautiful example of that. Christmas is the high point or low point of the sun when it starts going back the other direction for the summer months. It's the, I think they call it the winter solstice, or I've forgotten the exact name for that. But it's a solar deal. And it was worshipped by the pagans, had this day as a feast day to their gods and the god of the sun. Well, the Christians took this day over and made it Jesus' birthday. So it's common that happening in history. But whether that happened to the Passover or not, I just don't know. It is obvious that the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were two separate feasts that were later combined in either a 7-day feast or an 8-day feast. There's a lot of disagreement about which length of time it is. Now, if you want some Old Testament parallels to the Passover, it'd be Exodus 12, Numbers 28, and Deuteronomy 16. Notice the separation. In Exodus 12, the Passover is a family meal. The head of the house acts as the officiator. But in Deuteronomy 16, we're moving into an agricultural settled society, and now it's linked with the central shrine, which later was in Jerusalem. Now, here we're bringing two things together, a feast that dealt with the families and a feast that was centralized in the temple. And so you see how both of them have different backgrounds but have been brought together in one feast by Jesus' day. Now, this deal about 2 days. In John chapter 12, verse 1, it says, 6 days later, this deal with Mary happened, this anointing by Mary. Well, how can John say 6 days and Mark say 2 days and us not have a glaring contradiction? Well, I don't have all the answers to these kind of things. I will give you my opinion. I think verses 1 and 2 are the historical setting, 2 days later, and it's mentioning this about the Passover. But I think that verses 3 and following are a flashback, or a going back several days earlier to what happened. And I think John has the correct chronology. I think Mary anointed Jesus 6 days before Passover, but I think the introduction to chapter 14 is 2 days before Passover, but there's a brief flashback about this anointing of Mary. Now, that's all I'm going to do with it. Some people get really uptight about these number contradictions and date contradictions in the Bible. I just want to say to you, I, after years of study, believe the Bible is a supernatural book. I get that from predictive prophecy, verification of archaeology, Jesus doing a personal thing in my life. And so it doesn't bother me that I can't fully understand exactly how the Bible that I have in my hands came to be. These things, to me, aren't significant, but they bother some people so bad. I have a tape that I've dealt with on these kind of things. If you'd like that, if you'll write me, I'll make it available to you. Now, notice what it mentions. So the high priest and scribes kept looking for some way to arrest him by stratagem. Now, the high priest and scribes is the shortened designation for the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Usually it says the high priest, scribes, and elders. Now, the reason the word high priest is plural is because by the Roman times, the high priesthood was not a lifetime position to a certain family like it had been. But it became a political thing, and people bought and paid for the office, and there were several high priests still alive, and their families were alive, potential high priests. So it's a plural, the high priest. Now, it mentions they kept looking for some way to arrest him by stratagem and have him put to death. Well, isn't that unusual that the Jewish leaders have no problem in somehow... here they are, the religious judges of the day, and they don't see any contradiction in trying to have somebody killed. Well, that's strange, isn't it? It's not the first time they said this. Matter of fact, in chapter 3, verse 6, and chapter 11, verse 18, they had already started planning to kill him. Notice what they say. They were trying to get schemes whereby they could get him killed, but not, look at the last part of that verse, on the feast day, lest the crowd cause him trouble. Jesus was a very popular figure, and you can imagine that. People that everyone else excluded, Jesus loved and accepted. Tax collectors, lepers, women, children, the old. Man, Jesus just loved people, and they flocked to him. And so you can see why the pilgrims who would have been in Jerusalem and swelled the town to probably three times its normal population, many of them from Galilee and knew and supported Jesus. They were afraid to. They wanted a way to kill him, but they wanted to do it not at the festival. Now, feast day. Notice in verse 3 now, we're coming back to the particular scene that I want to deal with that deals with Mary. While he was in Bethany. Now, Bethany and Bethpage are some cities that are about 3 miles from Jerusalem. The rabbis encouraged everybody who lived in Jerusalem and the surrounding area that their homes did not belong to them only. And they were commanded to open their homes up during these festival times to let other Jews who were coming to the area to worship the temple to open their home to them. And there's much in rabbinical history about how Bethany and Bethpage fulfilled their obligations. They are known as the most hospitable cities around. They opened their doors to these pilgrims. And this is where Jesus was staying during this time. I'm sure there wasn't room in Jerusalem. So many people were there. Now, he was a guest in the home of Simon the leper. Now, whether Simon is still a leper or not, we're not sure, but obviously very few people would come to a dinner held by a leper. Leprosy was that unusual disease in the Old Testament that said if God didn't like you, he made you a leper. You know, if you did something wrong, you'd be a leper. It was that disease that was somehow the mark of God's disfavor. In the New Testament, they were terribly ostracized from family and friends and any kind of social gathering they couldn't come to. Maybe Jesus healed this man. But there's so many diseases the Old Testament calls leprosy that we would just call skin infections that cleared up normally over a period of time that we don't have any account of what happened to this man. But apparently he was cured, but he kept the nickname Simon the leper. Now, they were sitting at the table, my translation has in verse 3. That is horrendous. You know, the picture of the Last Supper with the disciples sitting at a long table is just historically inaccurate. They reclined on their left elbow, usually around a U-shaped table where someone could serve them from the middle. We're going to see how ridiculous this thing sitting at the table is. How is Mary going to reach his feet? Is she going to crawl around on her hands and knees under the table? No, it was quite easy to reach someone's feet who is reclining on the table and their feet are out behind them. So, if you're left-handed, boy, it really caused trouble at these kind of dinners. But there he is reclining at the table. Now, notice it says, a woman came with an alabaster jar. Now, it doesn't tell us here who her name is. Now, people say, well, why did it mention Mary? You know, Martha's sister, Lazarus' sister. Why did it name her? Well, think with me for a minute. It does name her in John chapter 12, let me see, verse 3, I believe. Yes, it names Mary. Why does it not name her in Mark? Well, let's think now the dates of the writing of these Gospels. Mark, we think, is the earliest Gospel, sometime around the 50s. And there was still much persecution going on. Maybe they were afraid to name these people lest they be persecuted for being Christians. But John was written toward the close of the first century, I think somewhere around 96 to 100 A.D. The persecution was somewhat over by then, although John was being persecuted. Maybe Mary had died by then with no reason to withhold her name. So he mentions it. That's a theory that's advocated by a man named Linsky, who's a Lutheran commentator that I like very much. And I think he probably has a good point here about that. Now, so a woman came in with an alabaster jar or bottle. Now, alabaster is a white, opaque kind of stone. It looked like a marble and crystal mix, maybe. These alabaster containers were such that once you broke the top off, you were not able to reseal it. So once it was opened, you had to use it. Now, we learn from the Gospel of John that this was a huge amount of perfume. John 12:3 says it was a whole pound. That was a big bottle of brut, I want to tell you. It says pure nard perfume. Now, the word pure, this is the only place this Greek word appears in the Bible. We think it means pure or unmixed, but we're not sure. And pure is just a guess. Now, nard comes from the root of a plant from Malaysia, from India, the Himalayas. And it's very aromatic, has a strong aroma, and it was used for many things. It's a very expensive thing. Look what it says. Very costly. She broke the bottle and poured the perfume on his head. Now, John 12:3 says on his feet. Now, let me just ask you, how much perfume do you think it would take to weigh a pound? Man, that was a lot of perfume. If she'd have dumped that whole thing on his head, it'd have ran off his ears and ran down his beard and made a big mess. I think that she probably anointed his whole body. John says the feet, Mark says the head. Probably she anointed everything. Which she did first, we don't know. Probably the head or the feet. I'm just not sure. But with the whole pound of perfume, man, can you imagine how that thing must have smelled? Woo! I bet that room just was. Have you ever got close to somebody who had too much perfume on? You know, it's almost instead of being pleasant, it's obnoxious. I bet that house reeked with the smell of this costly perfume. But she anoints him. Now, people were anointed for several reasons. To come into a home, it was a common thing to wash someone's feet, and it was very special to anoint them with oil, you know. People were anointed for parties. Many times in the Old Testament, speaks of the oil of gladness. They'd put things on, grease or olive oil on their skin to a sign of a party time or festival. It was also done for burial. They anointed people's bodies with spices and oils. Now, notice it says, but some of the guests were indignant, saying to themselves, why has such a waste this perfume been made? Now, we learn from John, again, chapter 12, verse 4 and 5, that it was Judas Iscariot. Now, that's turkey. He's the one that was the purse keeper for the group. The Bible says he had been stealing money out of that purse all along. He wasn't upset over the poor. He was upset because he didn't get a chance to steal some of that money. Uh-huh. Now, when it says some were indignant, maybe some of the other disciples on Judas's coaxing, going to say, yeah, that was kind of much. That was too much. You shouldn't have done that. The word here indignant. The word here in Greek is they were snorting like a horse. Boy, Jesus really is going to answer strong here. Why such a waste of perfume made? Look at verse 5. It might have been sold for more than $60. Now, it's very hard, and I think ridiculous, for us to translate these monetary things in the Bible. $60, when this translation that I use was written, doesn't equal $60 today. Inflation and the change of money and currency is ridiculous to try to translate these. It's 300 denarii. Now, the common wage for a soldier or for a day laborer was 1 denarii a day. This is almost a year's wage worth of perfume. Maybe it was Mary's diary that she broke. Boy, such extravagant. I don't know what you make a year. I think the median income now is around $18,000, $16,000. I don't know where it is, but can you imagine breaking a bottle of perfume worth almost $10,000 to $15,000 on somebody? This was extravagant to the extreme. Oh, it was lavish. It was an act of self-giving. I bet she was giving all of her diary, all of her savings kind of thing. What she was going to use to one day marry and give to the family of the husband, she extravagantly gives here to Jesus. Now, it says here that the money was to have been given to the poor. It seems to be a rabbinical tradition that during the Passover season, almsgiving was intensified. And you might want to see John 13:29 for that. But it was a notorious thing to give alms to the poor during this time. And these disciples are saying, we could have given that to the poor. And they're going to be surprised at Jesus' answer in verse 6. But before I get to Jesus' answer, here's my friend Phil Crenshaw with some opportunities for you.
Thank you for watching today. Bob will return in just a moment. We at the International Sunday School Lesson would like to take this opportunity to offer you a weekly exegetical outline of these Sunday School lessons free. This includes historical background, word and phrase study, and discussion questions. All we need is your address. Now, here is ours. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. Also, there is available free and postage paid the catalog of Bob's teachings on cassette tapes. This catalog includes over 900 subjects. We will be happy to send it to you this week so that you can order the tapes that interest you. Now, here is our address again. International Sunday School Lesson Incorporated, Post Office Box 2711, Lubbock, Texas, 79408. We would like to take this opportunity to thank you for your prayerful and financial support. You make this ministry possible and assure its continuation. Now, get a pencil and write today for the free material. Once again, here is Bob.
Thank you. Notice in verse 6, Jesus says, this is a paraphrase, sit down and cool it, Judas. It's an aorist imperative. He didn't say, now, Judas, would you please sit down? He said, sit down and leave her alone. Ooh, Judas. And so it's very strong. Let her alone. Why do you embarrass her? She has done a good deed to me. Now, Jesus makes a statement that's really been misinterpreted, I think. He says, "For the you always have the poor among you, and whenever you please, you can do them good, but you will always have me." People have said, well, Jesus didn't care about the poor. That's ridiculous. This is not saying the alms giving to the poor. He's not taking anything away from that. What he's saying is, you're going to always have people who can need your help. You're going to always have chances to give the poor. But you're not always going to have the Son of Man with you. You're not always going to have the bridegroom with you. You're not always going to have God incarnate with you. She's done something special for me. Get off her case. Leave her alone. You know, it's kind of like sometimes when Paul says, I don't baptize anybody, some people think that means that Paul was down on baptism. That's not what that verse means. It means that Paul is not saying anything disparaging about baptism in that verse, but that he just didn't do it because of the rivalry at Corinth. The same thing is here. Jesus is not saying, don't be concerned with the poor. Don't think about them. He's saying, I'm with you now, and this is special. Now, many think he is quoting Deuteronomy 15, verses 4 and 11, that deals with the Bible's obligation to the poor. You know, one of the things that amazed me about the Old Testament is the sensitivity of the nation of Israel to the orphan, the widow, the poor, the stranger, the alien, all of that. The Bible has a real love for the down and out, the socially ostracized. Friends, one of the real marks of a heart that is Christ-like is one that cares for those who are underprivileged and in need. You know, it's so easy to talk about Jesus loves you. But friends, if your life is not ministering to people who are underprivileged, then I think you really haven't got the perspective the New Testament wants, a radical commitment. And Jesus is not denying that in any way, shape, or form here. He's saying they'll always be here. But this is a special time, a unique time. I'm a special person. Now, he continues in verse 8 and says, she has done all she could. She has beforehand perfumed my body for burial. Lo and behold, could this woman have known? The disciples are still arguing over it. They still don't understand what's happening. Jesus told them four times, as we looked last week, I'm going to Jerusalem to die, and they still were surprised when it happened. Could it be that this lady who had been so sensitive to sit at Jesus' feet and listen to his teachings and still worry about the dinner as Martha was, could it be that somehow she knew that he was coming to die? Could it be that she was actually performing to him while he was alive the rite of burial? I really think that may be true. I think she may have seen clearer than all those disciples what Jesus had talked about and what he was about to experience. Because being anointed for burial, it seems ridiculous, you know, so many days before he actually was killed and buried. And yet he says that that's what she did it for. That was the symbol she wanted to do. How beautiful. Now, verse 9, I solemnly say to you, all over the world, wherever this good news is proclaimed, the deed that she has done will also be told in her memory. Now, you know, that must have really shocked those Jews. First of all, to say all over the world, I'm sure they thought, well, surely just among the Jews of the diaspora. But I think Jesus really realized who and what he was, and that his church was going to spread over the entire world, and that the Bible was going to be read in every culture and every tongue around this entire globe. And he says, all over the world. I don't think he was thinking about Palestine or the Middle East. I think he was actually saying, in a veiled sense, this good news about me is going to be worldwide, transcultural, transgenerational. That's significant. And wherever it's read, this lady's testimony is going to be recorded about her. He knew that one of the Gospels were going to record it and people would know about it. I think that's significant that he had that kind of insight. This universal element was so repugnant to the Jews. They thought the Gentiles were only good. You know, the rabbis say that the Gentiles were made by God to keep the fires of hell burning. What a tremendous purpose in life. But even though Jesus in his lifetime did not go to the Gentiles over and over again, he'd heal them, he'd deal with them. I think he said, I came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. When he says, you'll do greater works than I have done, I think he's referring to the Gentile mission. And it wasn't the apostles that first pushed that. It was the seven who were elected in Acts chapter 6 who later became the real pushers of the worldwide Gentile mission out of Antioch of Syria. But I think here we have a little foreshadowing of that kind of emphasis. when it speaks of this good news, the gospel's not finished yet. Jesus hadn't died and come back to life. But Jesus knew that his teachings, the way he acted, the way he dealt with people, what he said about God, this is also a very important reason why Jesus came. Last week we talked about that Jesus came to die, Mark 10:45. This week the emphasis seems to be that Jesus came to teach who God is, what God is like. Jesus didn't come primarily to heal, but to teach. And I think it's important that we see that when we look at why Jesus came, he came certainly to give his life a ransom for many, the vicarious substitutionary atonement. But he also came to reveal to us the Father. I think Hebrews chapter 1, verses 2 and 3 is a clear expression of that. That he came to show us what God is really like. And so he's mentioned here this good news about himself. Well, I really have enjoyed being with you. I think these little cameos of personalities are so needed. You know, I think sometimes we make the Bible characters bigger than life. They're just human beings like us. They have moments of greatness and moments of failure. In the same chapter is Peter's denial. So, you know, we have moments when men seem so strong and moments when they seem so weak. And that's just like us. If God can use the people of the New Testament and the people of the Old Testament, God can use us. People with feet of clay. Think about that. God really cares about you and loves you just the way you are. I've enjoyed being with you. I hope to see you same time, same place next week.